The most unexpected thing happened the other day. I was having car issues and the mechanic offered to do a home visit, and that in itself was a really nice gesture. He found the issue, resolved it pretty quickly, actually. If you're dying to know, it was an electrical issue, well beyond my expertise. Okay, let's be honest. I have no expertise beyond the Radio Shack Club at the summer camp I attended as a kid, but I soldered that motion detector pretty well. Of course, you had to be like 4 inches from it to detect you. Very effective. So we're chit-chatting, and through the window he sees a ukulele sitting on a table, and he takes out a guitar from his vehicle, and we find ourselves in a little jam session. And I can safely say that this was not how I expected my day to go. I didn't have the time for this, so I had to consciously say to myself to embrace the change, lean into the unknown, be okay with a different plan. My guest today had to do all those things, but she had to do it on a grand scale, and I'll introduce her formally in a moment. But let me just say that Misha Porter joined me this week. She was called to service, a mammoth job, and from all accounts, she did it with distinction. And from my story from a moment ago, I can say that we were just, you know, noodling on our stringed instruments with no expectation of being any good. In Misha's case, she was tasked with something tantamount to conducting a full symphony. In the episode, she tells us a story that she has not previously discussed publicly. I'm Peter Stiepelman, and welcome to An Imperfect Leader. Thanks for tuning in. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Dr. Misha Porter is my guest. Dr. Porter is the Bronx Community Foundation's inaugural president and CEO, but previously, she held the position of Chancellor of the New York City Department of Education, first Black woman to serve in New York City's Chancellor, and that's a big deal because you're talking about the largest school system in the nation. To put that into context for those who are listening, let me share what that means. She was responsible for educating 1.1 million students in over 1,800 schools. Crazy. And prior to taking on that role as chancellor, she served as the Bronx Executive Superintendent, where she was deeply invested in sharpening school leaders' equity lenses, building collaborative practices across schools. And she has served as the superintendent for Community School District Number 11 and as a teacher and a community coordinator and the principal, the Bronx School for Law, Government, and Justice. We're going to talk a little bit about that as well. But let me just begin with a welcome. So, Dr. Misha Porter, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Misha, it's such an honor to have you as a guest. And I must admit, I am really excited about segment two when you walk through a decision you made and then consider how it could have gone differently. Because really, if I was saying with 19,000 kids, like, they said what? And they did what? I can only imagine what that looks like when you're juggling a staggering 1.1 million children. And so, but we'll simply have to wait because we have other important things to talk about. So, for example, I mentioned that you're the Bronx Community Foundation's inaugural president and CEO, and it must have been gratifying to continue serving New Yorkers, especially in your home borough of the Bronx. And so, would you tell us just a little bit about the Bronx Community Foundation?
Sure. Thank you. So the Bronx Community Foundation is the first and only community foundation in the borough of the Bronx. And if you know a little bit about the landscape of New York City, the Bronx is the blackest and brownest borough in New York City. It is home to, a large, diverse population of people. It also is home to a lot of the problems that exist in our city, exists multifold in the Bronx. High levels of food insecurity, high levels of lack of access to digital and technological spaces, many families who are food insecure, housing insecure, and has had some of the lowest academic performance rates. And so, you know, I have had the privilege and pleasure of living, raising my family, and also leading in the Bronx for many, many years. And so I've seen the other side of that story, right? I've seen the other side of like the power of the people of the borough of the Bronx. I've seen the other side of young people coming through challenging circumstances and doing amazing things. And so as I was transitioning out of New York City, I started to think about what I wanted to do with my time. And I wanted to do work that was important to me, meaningful to me, work that connected to who I was as a person. And I think what people don't know is I actually started my career, my professional journey in the nonprofit space. At 17 years old, I started working for Richard Kahn at the Urban Assembly and leading a youth group. And what that youth group did was looked at this 300 square block area in the Bronx and came up with innovative solutions to what was then called an empowerment zone. And ultimately, the school that I led grew out of that. And so to be back in this moment on the other side, leading the Bronx Community Foundation, for me, was like my story full circle, right? The foundation, community foundations are about place-based giving. They're also about participatory grant making. And so how do you bring people who are closest to the problem to the forefront to help think about solutions and decide where resources go to solve them? So it is an exciting place to be. And it met all of the things that were important to me post leaving my career in education.
You know, so many of us are familiar with the term an empowerment zone, or you know, it sounds like you predated Jeffrey Canada with a children's zone, right? That's pretty. He owes you,
but and he's from the Bronx, so you're right. He owes me.
He does owe you. That's pretty.
He
funny.
Knows that he's a friend, so
he, all right, good.
He will not
good. I didn't want to have to be the one to have to tell him. I didn't want to be the one to tell him. It's interesting though, one of the themes that constantly comes back during this podcast conversation with leaders around the country is that very idea that you just mentioned, is that you make decisions with the people most impacted. And that's mm-hmm. exactly what you're doing. You know, superintendents, as you know, they have these strategic plans or they have scorecards. It's a way to keep track of their progress. And I looked at the Bronx Community Foundation's five pillars: community, equity and justice, economic security, health, and digital equity. And you spoke a little bit about those things in my question about the foundation. I was curious, how are you measuring success? I think that would be something that, you know, leaders around the country are kind of interested yeah. in as they're sort of establishing their pillars. You know, yeah. how do you describe your process to people who are interested?
That's a really good question. And some of it is being defined, right? Like when, you know, when I took the job, I said the first thing I wanted to do was have conversations. And so we spent the last 6 months in the strategic planning process. We also spent the entire summer engaging residents around our pillars to think about and to envision the ideal Bronx. And so we had conversations about all of those things, about food, about housing, about education, about digital equity. And we wanted to make sure, and so this is like our first success criteria. We engaged over 1,000 residents. We worked with over 17 nonprofits. We knew it wasn't our conversation to lead. It was our conversation to have in partnership. And so I think the first thing is that people came out and contributed to those conversations was a big indicator of success, right? Like as a school leader, right? I have had captured audiences. I didn't have to worry about how I would get people in a room. I just created the room and put the people in it and I could ask them whatever I want. But this was folks voluntarily saying, I want to give up my time to one, understand what this foundation is going to do for the borough, and two, and inform what it does for the borough. And so an initial success criteria was to one, get nonprofits to partner with us on it. And then two, to get, you know, we initially were like 500 residents and we doubled that and exceeded that, but to really get residents in the room. Because one of the things we wanted to do was define community. And sometimes people define community as the folks who are elected, as the folks who run the businesses, right? As the folks who lead. And those people are all very important. But the other folks that are important are the folks that are impacted by the decisions that get made. And so, you know, the first success criteria for us was defining that. What will come of it, and it will be defining further our success criteria, is identifying where we will invest as a grant maker, where we will be a convener, and where we will be strategic in programming. And so the foundation is ultimately going to do those three things. We're going to be a grant maker who seeds and incubates ideas, and we're going to develop strategic programs in areas that we have expertise. And obviously education will be one of them, digital equity, because there's a need and a gap in the Bronx, is one of them. So I think it is evolving, our success criteria, and is evolving as we continue to have conversations with residents. So I would say my immediate one is continuing to engage residents and to, you know, kind of share this plan and build a level of investment for the Bronx. And I'll just add, I think, you know, as a philanthropist now, I tell people I'm not a philanthropist, I'm a Bronxist. I like that better. When I was a superintendent.
Well, they're philanthropic people in the Bronx anyway. So, yeah, you know, it's almost like being redundant, right?
Exactly. When I was a superintendent, I loved being a principal. That was my favorite job. And when I was chancellor, I would tell people I'm the lead principal, right? So I always like to redefine the job to be the one I want it to be. But, you know, the other success criteria is going to be, we have a big goal. We want to build a $100 million foundation for the borough over the next 10 years. And so our success criteria is going to be, how do we get there and charting a pathway to that place?
These are really ambitious goals. It's fantastic. Two takeaways that I heard as you were talking. One, the fact that you recognize that there are already entities in that space in your borough trying to do this work. And so serving as not the, aren't you lucky I'm here? Aren't you glad I arrived? And more as a convener and trying to almost approach it from that appreciative inquiry kind of approach, right? That we know as superintendents, what's going well? How do we get more of it? As opposed to we're here to fix things. And the second piece that I heard was this working to get a shared image. And I think that's something that superintendents are always working on, which is, you know, any word from like morale to engagement, you know, what do those words mean? And do we have a shared image so that we're all working on the same strategies? So for you, that word community, what does that mean? Is it the elected officials? Is it all of us, right? No one's coming to save us. We're going to save ourselves kind of thing, because that's what communities do. They take care of each other.
And I'll tell you, Peter, that is, I think, more true for the Bronx than a lot of places. You know, the Bronx has a historic story of disinvestment. And I tell people all the time, two presidents came to the Bronx to use it as an example of urban blight. Jimmy Carter came to the Bronx and Ronald Reagan came to the Bronx.
Wasn't Reagan standing in front of like Co-op City?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. And they left. And each time that happened, you know, folks in the borough didn't say, what are they going to do for us? Folks in the borough said, thanks for coming. Now we're going to start rebuilding our community, and we're going to physically start building our buildings back. We're going to shift this narrative for ourselves. And so I am so proud of the people of the Bronx and the way that they've shown up in service of themselves,
Amazing.
Of ourselves.
Right. In my book and in the leadership model that I use to advise others, there are three dimensions. And at the center of the model is a culture of deep learning. Mm-hmm. And in learning more about you, I learned that deeper learning, you know, where teachers serve as activators and children have opportunities to explore their interests and engage in project-based learning, that deeper learning is important to you as well. And I know that you were involved, I think it was cohort 4, right?
Yes,
with the Deeper Learning Equity Fellowship.
Yes.
Yeah. Look, I do my homework, Misha.
You did a good job. That has been, you never know. And I think you probably notice, right? Like, but you never know how a space is going to prepare you for the things that you will ultimately do. When I started a Deeper Learning Fellow, and shout out to Big Picture Learning, who's really led the fellowship. And I think cohort 7 is beginning. And so, you know, I got to be in community with folks from all over the country who were thinking about what deeper learning meant for young people.
Yeah.
And in that space, I connected with a cross section of folks, education, nonprofit leaders, school-based leaders, system level leaders. And it really helped me to think about, you know, to me, school is the center of community, but there's so much around it. There's so much richness around it that cultivates the opportunity to think about who are our partners at the building level, right?
I would love to just talk about one in particular, which is the Bronx School for Law, Government, and Justice.
Yes.
I mean, it just seems like everything you're describing right now, that this is like the model for that. I wonder, would you tell us just about that?
It's my happy place. You know, so I was, you know, I told you I started as a youth organizer at 17 years old. And one of the things I got to do as a young person was design a school, the Bronx School for Law, Government, and Justice, the first urban assembly school. And the school I became the principal of, a teacher of, right, did all these jobs in. But what was really unique about the Bronx School for Law, Government, and Justice was it grew out of this, the development of a new Supreme Court complex that was it became a criminal court complex. We thought it was going to be a Supreme Court, but it was a criminal court complex that was being built in the Bronx. And young people rose up and said, we don't need another court. That's just more jails in our communities, but we don't have adequate schools. And so we came together and we started designing a school that would be connected to the courthouse. So young people would learn the inner workings of the court system, not by going through it, but by being in partnership with it. And so we had relationships with the court, with the district attorney. Actually, the Bronx district attorney, Darcel Clark, who's the district attorney now, was a judge and coached students on our mock trial team and worked with them. And so we really wrapped ourselves around who are the critical partners around us and how can we help them to, how can we connect them to bring real learning experiences to young people? We had probation officers and court officers. We had access to so many people who worked in the system that our young people learned so much about the system. Police officers, right? Our young people learned about careers they would want to pursue from the people who were in those careers. And then what happened also was because of where we were physically located, we shared a campus and continue to this day to share a campus with the criminal court complex. All of the folks who worked in those buildings became protectors of our kids, right? LGJ kids wear blue shirts and black slacks. Middle schoolers wear white shirts and black pants. And so they knew our kids. They knew them when they saw them. They knew they went to LGJ. And there became this whole community wrapped around the success of these young people who were pursuing learning.
Yeah, in a brand of achievement, an identity. Yeah, that's super cool.
Yeah. So yeah. It was awesome. And one of my favorite places ever.
I can tell we could make just an entire episode on for those, because it's just an audio podcast for those who, because I can see Misha right now, like her whole body like lit up when it was yes. Like, let's talk about that. So, and it actually, I'll tell you, there's a law professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. His name is David Mitchell, and he's got roots from the Bronx and from Manhattan. And he's a tort professor, and he does a street law class, and he does exactly that, real learning, mock trials. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And that's just an episodic sort of one time to think that this is part of a deep system, a whole school. I'm going to have to tell them to go visit. See, it's pretty cool.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd like to ask you a question that I ask every guest who comes on the podcast. Mm-hmm. How does the term an imperfect leader resonate with you?
So I always say, right, like our students show up perfectly imperfect at our doorsteps. And I think leaders are the same, right? It doesn't matter, you know, when we show up in new spaces and new leadership positions, we come with all of the things from our prior positions. And, you know, and I think we have to be comfortable and okay with that. Sometimes we feel this desire to be the perfect principal, the perfect superintendent, and that person doesn't exist. What I think exists is the opportunity to lead perfectly in your imperfectness. And so one of the things that I always thought about as a leader was I luckily got to move up in the ranks. And, you know, I always thought about the what leader would I want if I was sitting in the seat that I just left? And I think the imperfect leader, right, is always going back to that place of, you know, where I sat before. And I think imperfection is powerful because it helps you grapple with things you don't know. I think when we desire to be the perfect leader, then we set ourselves up for failure. And we set the systems and the people we lead up for failure. When I was a principal, when I first became a principal, I felt that pressure. Like, I gotta be the best, I gotta be perfect. Everybody needs these things from me, I gotta have the answers. And one day I said to my assistant principals, you know, they asked me a question, I don't even remember the question. I was like, I don't know. I just don't know. And I need you all to start letting me say that, because I find myself feeling pressured to answer things that I don't always have the answers to. And the answers that, like, you all need to help me figure out. And I think the perfect leader feels like they have to have those answers. The imperfect leader is comfortable with their imperfections, because, like, as you work and develop those imperfections, you grow to a state of more perfected.
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being, and I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of an imperfect leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, They shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class. And the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of An Imperfect Leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. And my guest is Dr. Misha Porter, former chancellor of the New York City Department of Education, and now the president and CEO of the Bronx Community Foundation. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they had to make, and then we discuss it. So Misha, what happened?
So the school calendar came out. It's probably my second week officially as chancellor. I was actually at a visit at my high school that I graduated from. So I was very excited to be there as chancellor. And a reporter asked me, "So tell us about the decision to change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day." And I did not know we had made that decision, but I gave a good answer. And I said, you know, that's been a conversation that's been happening for some time. And, you know, we just had to get there. It was a good kind of press bite answer, but it wasn't the right answer. And it wasn't the right response in the moment. And I say that as is my mistake, because I didn't take time to understand not only where the question came from, but what was happening outside of the moment that I was literally standing in about that decision, right? Like the calendar dropped while I was at the school. It started this uproar across New York City about this change. And a lot of folks hadn't been a part of the decision-making process, right? Whether I agreed or disagreed was irrelevant. What was relevant was that there were many voices that didn't feel heard on a very sensitive matter and decision. And so I also didn't pay attention to what was coming and the implications of what was going to come as a result of this thing that I didn't realize was so big for so many people.
Okay, so here we go. So this is what I understand to be true. You've been named chancellor. You're 2 weeks on the job. You're out and about as you need to be present and be seen. And how wonderful that you are at the high school where you graduated, right? So, and you get a question about the school calendar has been released, and you get a question about, so do you have a comment about changing Columbus Day? And in New York and in the five boroughs and in Long Island, and there are parades for Columbus Day. I mean, yeah, that's a shift, right? So you get a question. So tell us about shifting it from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. And you give a good response, right? There's probably has been a lot of conversation around this topic, and it was time to move on. Okay, what got overlooked?
First of all, I didn't even realize that it had dropped that day, right? So, I didn't even realize the calendar was dropping, and I didn't realize how many people like spend their lives waiting for the school calendar to drop. I really didn't. Like, even though I'm a parent, I did it myself. I'm like, okay, now we can plan Easter. Now we can plan vacations. But I just didn't realize how big it was for people. I didn't know it was dropping. And so that's first. The other thing that was overlooked, while I gave a press-worthy response, I didn't think about the political implications of the decision and the other work that I would have to do. And so I think the other thing that was overlooked was who's responsible for deciding that the calendar is going to drop, and who's responsible, ultimately me, right? But who in my immediate sphere of influence is responsible for making sure I know hot button items when something is dropping publicly. And so I just overlooked them, right? Answered in the moment, and then turned around and was like, oh, dip.
I imagine, because my next question is, what'd you learn about relationships? And I imagine the moment you say, well, there have been a lot of conversations, that there are those who may not have been part of any conversations, are going, well, why were we excluded?
Right.
And
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I learned, right? Like, I learned that the conversations, the many conversations, were internal conversations. They weren't external. They weren't with communities. They weren't with the communities who would be affected. And I very much believe, like, we don't have to agree. Sometimes, you know, we do this all the time, right? We have to make policy decisions that we know somebody's not going to agree with, right? Like, I don't know that there's ever been a policy decision that everybody agreed with. But those conversations can't be internal. They just can't, right? Like, and when it is, you know, so many, the calendar decision, the changing of the name of a holiday that means a lot to folks, you got to include those folks. You got to have conversations with the people that are impacted by the decision you make. You can't just have the conversation with people who are going to be excited about the decision. You have to have the conversation with people who are actually going to be angry with you about the decision.
What frustrated you?
I think what frustrated me was more about internal stuff. It was what I learned about the layers in a system. And it came down to, there was one person on a team who made the change based on internal conversations, for sure. Like, it wasn't a singular decision, but didn't have the foresight to say, and I don't know that it was that person's responsibility. I'll tell you a funny story about that person too, but didn't think, we have a new chancellor who is a Black woman, the first one in this role. This needs to be escalated, that this is going to drop. And I don't blame that person. I don't know that that person was the responsible party, right? Because they didn't start the conversation. But I was frustrated by, there was no one around me who shared with me that was coming. So I could make a decision to be indifferent about it or not, right? I might have been indifferent about it because there were so many things I didn't realize about the calendar and right, the communities that were going to be affected. I might have been indifferent about it, but I was frustrated about not owning that indifference or non-indifference.
Did you have a brain trust, sort of a group of people that
I
would
did,
come together?
But this, yeah, I did. And actually, when I was announced, it was very, very, very tight. It probably was the best kept secret in New York City, really. And it happened very quickly. It was like a conversation that started on a Thursday evening, that resulted in a week later, the following Thursday, me being announced. So there were very few people that I was able to talk to about it.
Gotcha.
But when I was able to, there were, five people who are really close to me, who've been really close on my journey, who we just went away and said, okay, now what are we going to do? And how are we going to support you in this role? The other thing that was important, and I think that's part of why you do this, right? Like, just because of, how we survive the superintendency, the chancellorship, or whatever it's called, wherever you are. The other thing that was important was, I live and work in New York City. We were in the middle of an election cycle, and New York City is run by mayoral control. So while I had to do this job, and I had to do it well, and it was a really important job to do, I also had to be thinking about what else I wanted to do. Because, in a mayoral control system, the next mayor gets to decide who they want to be chancellor. And I respect that as a voter and as an educator in New York City. And so at the same time, I had to be thinking about and thinking with my brain trust about, so what are the next steps for me as well?
Yeah. So positioning yourself in terms of professionally, what are the things that are going to matter over this next 9 to 12 months? And I think for you is about 9 months before Mayor Adams came in. So that's an interesting sort of dynamic that most system leaders don't need to consider because they are elected by a board of education. And not even elected, they're selected.
So yeah.
That's interesting. What could you have done differently?
Oh, wow.
Right. So my first question was, what got overlooked? And sometimes that's by the system. And I feel like you really took it from a systems perspective of, like, there are multiple layers. There's the internal system and the external system. Internally, we were having these conversations. Clearly, there were individuals responsible for making these decisions. But that doesn't always talk about you. Right. And so what could you have done differently?
I think one, I could have not answered the question. And again, like it goes back to my principal days when I felt like I have to have the answer. I think I could have not answered the question and got more information before I answered the question. I think that's the biggest thing that I would have done because I answered the question, I had to almost backtrack and figure out, was that actually the answer to the question? And so I think in retrospect, I would have not answered the question. I would have no commented the reporter or
like really big question. We're moving on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Make sure you get back in touch with me. I'd love to talk about this more with you or something along those lines. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's really good learning for our superintendents around the nation who are asked by their local papers and sometimes from larger, outlets for a comment. And it's okay to say, let me get back to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the end, what was something that was good that came out of the situation?
In the end, I had a lot of really important conversations. I learned a lot about different communities. We ultimately we didn't change it back to Columbus Day. We found, I think, what was a happy medium for many, not all. Definitely, it was important to me. And so we left it as Italian American Heritage Day and Indigenous Peoples Day. And so I think that was the right thing to do, because it was also at a time where like the city and across the country, this is happening, right, was very sensitive about landmarks and statues and Columbus, the idea of Columbus sat in the center of that.
Italian heritage flying under a Spanish flag day.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. You seek common ground. Even if it doesn't always taste great, because what you're trying to do is demonstrate that you really are listening. And sometimes we get in trouble as soups when we do try to seek common ground. What advice would you give to an aspiring leader?
I think my first thing would be, what this podcast is about, right? Like, you're not going to be perfect. Like, perfection is a desired state that you might sit in momentarily, but it is not a perpetual state. And so, don't try to live there. It's hard. It's painful. And so I would do my very best not to live there. I think the other advice I would give is, really think about where you lead. There are people who want jobs and positions. And I think the biggest mistake is about landing in a place that isn't a good fit for you. Because it's the job you want, because it's the title you want, because it's the position you want. Fit to me is like the ultimate decider of a role. And so I think that, right, like as people seek out these roles, they have to think about the fit. They got to think about, what's the story of the leaders that have come before me? And I think the last thing that I would offer folks, and I am deeply committed to supporting women in the superintendency, particularly women of color. I think it can often be very dangerous for us. Think about your journey while you're on this journey. I had to do it, and not everyone has to do it, but we should be doing it. We should be thinking about, whether you want to do the job until you retire, whether you want to do the job for a couple of years, where do you want the job to take you? It's okay. It's not selfish to be selfless and thinking about what you want for yourself. And I think we often, work in these spaces from a real aspirational space of what we want to do and who we want to be. And we don't think about or really center ourselves as the superintendency is sometimes a short journey. And where is it the journey to?
I almost felt like you were talking directly to me. You made me feel a lot better. My guest again today was Dr. Misha Porter, former chancellor of the New York City Department of Education, and now the president and CEO of the Bronx Community Foundation. You and I, we got a chance to meet each other a few months back, and I have so been looking forward to this conversation. And you didn't disappoint, I'll tell you that. And it sounds like I've got a story that no one else has heard yet about Indigenous Peoples Day and Italian-American Heritage Day. So that's exciting. But truly, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for your genuineness. I want to thank you for your human-centered approach to leading and learning. And I love this idea of being perfectly imperfect. This has been a real treat. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print-inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.